your fault. Baby, it's not mine. Not chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, be no doubt when you see you are. Grass make dab in the middle of it. Grass make dab in the middle. We are grass make dab.
Secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler along with my co-host,
Charlotte Littlefield. Good evening, George.
Charlotte, how are you? Boy, how's the weather up there in Missouri?
Well, not as bad as it could have been. We're getting by just fine, thank you. How's it down in Texas?
Okay, we've had really fine weather, 65, 70 degrees during the day, but so it's wonderful. We've got one of the finest guests this evening that we've ever had, and he has quite a story. His name is Bradley C. Birkenfeld, and he's an American, but he worked extensively most of his career in Switzerland for UBS Bank. And he's written a book. The title is Lucifer's Banker. It's a fascinating behind-the-scenes look at the secret Swiss banking industry. And he became a whistleblower at a point during his career while still working for UBS Bank. Welcome to our program, Bradley Birkenfeld.
Well, George and Charlotte, thank you for having me on. I'm delighted to be here today and to tell your audience about something they're never going to hear again. This is once-in-a-lifetime story.
Boy, Bradley, tell us, give us a little background about your early career and then how you wound up working for UBS, and give us a little story here about how this unfolded.
Yeah, Bradley, educate us. I really am curious.
Well, it's put an end to Swiss bank secrecy, what I did, and my career started in banking in Boston where I grew up, and after about 4 years of working at State Street Bank as a currency trader, I got a little bit tired of the same old routine and was curious to explore Europe, so I applied to an MBA program in Switzerland, traveled over to Switzerland, sold everything in the States, and completed my MBA there in Switzerland. And was hired by Credit Suisse Private Bank in Geneva to assist them in their private banking division. So it was really quite an opportune time, not only to get a master's degree in Switzerland, but also to get a job and a work permit in Switzerland for one of the largest banks at the time, which was Credit Suisse. After Credit Suisse, I stayed there for a couple of years, and then my boss went over to Barclays Bank in Geneva to do the same business. So I followed him over there. He brought me with him. And I worked there for about 4 or 5 years. And then I was recruited by a headhunting firm in London to go to UBS in Geneva. So I elected to take that position, and it was quite an opportune time for me as a young man. And I enjoyed my time in Switzerland. I really did. I worked for the three big banks I just mentioned over about a 10-year period and had a wonderful lifestyle.
Well, I tell you what, it says in here you drove fast cars and beautiful women and wined and dined. A lot of you are very important and very wealthy. You had a lot of wealthy customers or clients, did you not?
Well, that's it. At UBS, to open a numbered account in Switzerland, the minimum account size was $1 million. And so you can imagine some of these clients were well above that, 5, 10, 20, $50 million accounts. And they lived a very, very high lifestyle. And these were the rich and famous people of the world. And UBS handled 19,000 accounts with $20 billion in assets just in America.
My gosh. Now, what set this up? Was there an early bank law, secrecy law in 1934 in Switzerland that began this this business of secret bank accounts? Is that when it first started or what? What's the background on the secrecy banking laws in Switzerland?
Well, it's a great question, George. I think for your audience, it's important to understand when we think about Swiss bank secrecy, which is no longer in place because of my unprecedented whistleblowing, but it's similar to attorney-client privilege or privilege with your doctor, medical privilege. So people understand that you need to keep certain information discreet and private, and there's a reason for that. The problem was that when Adolf Hitler came to power, the Third Reich in the 30s, they passed a law that said anyone who moved money out of Germany could be shot. So Switzerland countered that law in 1934, Article 47, and said we will never disclose the identity of any customer that puts money in Switzerland. So it made sense at the time to have this law, and they were countering the Nazi regime at the time, which was very oppressive, as we know. But over the years, as the world became more global, and then we had more nefarious acts such as the arms dealing and drug dealing and the slave trade or human trafficking, as we call it, all of these nefarious acts became greater and greater, and people were looking for a place to hide their money. Certainly Switzerland was a prime target for that, being in Central Europe, not having any political problems, not having economic problems. So the stability of those two factors were very important, as well as having Swiss bank secrecy on top of it. So you can imagine clients from all over the world were very interested to hide their money, not just for tax evasion purposes, but also for insider trading, bribery, extortion, kickbacks, you name it. It was going on in Switzerland.
So Switzerland became a clearinghouse for people from very nefarious or even some pretty honest people that wanted to hide big amounts of money from either their home countries or they could be kickback schemes too, you're saying, right?
Well, that's exactly right. And it could also be that they were hiding money from a spouse, a husband from a wife, or a wife.
Oh, right, right.
And or a business partner. You may not trust a business partner. You want to hide some money as well. So there's so many different ways, as well as the tax man, that people were looking to hide money. And it was an insurance policy against all kinds of other problems that might go on in the world, such as political instability, economic instability. So Switzerland was a prime target. And in Geneva, where I lived at the time, they had, in 2007, they had about 140 banks. As of today, they have around 85 banks. So you can see that this has really taken its toll on the banking industry, because without Swiss bank secrecy, what do you have? You have to compete with the rest of the banking world.
Now, two other factors that I've run across in my own studies is that during World War II, Alan Dulles was working for the OSS in Bern, Switzerland. And in addition to that, the BIS was doing some funny things too, were they not? The Bank of International Settlements. How does that figure into this Swiss bank secrecy laws and so forth?
Well, you know, George and Charlotte, the thing for your audience to understand is very simple. If we don't have accountability and transparency, then we have problems because we don't know what's going on, whether it's the Federal Reserve today or it's the BIS back in the 40s during World War II. And what happens here is that when you have this cloak of secrecy in any kind of business, you begin to wonder, wait a minute, we need to have more openness, more transparency, because then we can't really see if we're being told the truth. So I think you really have a problem in Switzerland. Used to take all kinds of money from dictators, drug dealers, terrorist financing, for instance. So if you're not going to delve into where the money came from, then you've got a serious problem. And what happened was Switzerland was an area where you could come and go with cash at any time. And that was standard operating procedure.
Right.
People could come into a bank and take out $100,000, $200,000 in cash without even a question.
Right. You say in here, as your whistleblowing unfolded, that our Department of Justice was scornful of your attempts to do whistleblowing. How did that work out? I mean, is it so rigged now that they did not want you to get into this on a deep level? Is that sort of what you're saying there in your book?
Well, that's exactly right. In my book, Lucifer's Banker, And there's a great website that supports the book, lucifersbanker.com, for your audience.
It's we've got that up, and I took this talking points thing, and that's up also. So they're going to be able to see your impact and things right on our site. They'll be able to link it into your own site also. So they'll get a really good insight, and we'll generate some interest in your book, that's for sure.
Well, I think this is it. Thank you for that. And I think your audience will be impressed with the book because it really opens their eyes to the way in which the U.S. government has really screwed the American people, George. This is a very serious, very serious case because they tried to bury the case and they tried to scapegoat me and make me the bad guy. All of my bosses were let go. They got these secret non-prosecution agreements. The U.S. Senate, till this day, will not give me my sworn testimony. They won't give it to me. The Department of Justice was hostile from day one. They don't even understand what was going on in that part of the world. So people would say, well, wait a minute, why weren't you doing your job? And if you're doing your job, you should have uncovered this decades ago. But they didn't. It took a courageous whistleblower to come forward and expose this billion-dollar business that was operating right under their noses. And what it was exposing all the rich politicians and millionaires and billionaires in the United States. So why would they want to wreck some of the people that are going to give them jobs in private practice once they leave the Department of Justice? It's that age-old revolving door, George, and it's really quite serious.
Right, the Panama revelations, and then also the revelations that have come out from Assange on his WikiLeaks, would that indicate the sleeping giant, the Hillary, the Clinton Foundation? Is this how this thing has been going on for decades?
Well, that's exactly right. I actually met with Julian Assange in London. I went to the Ecuadorian embassy and met with him for an hour and a half in November of last year. And he gave me some very good insight to exactly what was going on, which really I agreed with some of his assessments, which was very simple. Hillary Clinton, first and foremost, never should have gotten involved in an international criminal investigation, but she did. And on my website under the UBS scandals, if you look under documents, you'll see a CIA cable there, which was released by WikiLeaks, that shows that Hillary, as the Secretary of State, under President Obama's orders, came to a political solution to the UBS case. Now, George, this is extremely serious, and as the president is leaving office, you can understand that he should have been impeached over this case.
Right, right.
Senator Obama was a acting member of the Senate committee that was investigating UBS because of my whistleblowing. But he never showed up for any of those hearings, George, not one. But at the same time he was not attending those hearings on the criminal investigation into UBS, he was taking millions of dollars from UBS for his presidential campaign.
Oh, my gosh.
You got it, George.
Well, I tell you, you nailed that, man. My idea basically was that the public doesn't know all of the details sometimes about what's going on to the level and the depth that you do, but they felt like if all of these big power people were against Trump, then we're going to vote for Trump. That's sort of what I saw the public at large and the American public react to during this campaign. What do you think?
Well, that's exactly right, and the problem was the media really never gave me – some media outlets were good to me. They were reporting the truth and so forth. 60 Minutes was a total disaster. It's a fraudulent network, and I can say that, because they do not report the truth. I gave them information on terrorist financing, and I gave them information – in my book, it's in my book – a Iraqi national who lived in a $50 million condo in New York City had $420 million in six numbered secret accounts in Switzerland at UBS. DOJ told me they were not interested in non-Americans. And I told them this is important. We have to go after this. And they said, we're not interested. And when I said this to Steve Croft on 60 Minutes, he says, well, what should we do? I said, you know, Steve, you should probably go talk to the 3,000 family members that had their loved ones murdered on 9/11 and ask them if they care. Because the Department of Justice said they don't care.
My gosh. Your impact, though, and we have it listed here on our website, was fantastic impact. I mean, they paid what? UBS paid $780 million in fines. The entire Swiss executive management was fired of UBS. UBS entered into a deferred prosecution agreement with the U.S. UBS forced to reveal 4,700 secret bank accounts. UBS, and goes on and on. But, my gosh, Bradley, you have really done a service in trying to break up this real crooked secrecy bank hiding of assets and tax evasion and wheeling and dealing, have you not?
Well, that's exactly right, George. I did the best thing I could for my country, and some people argue, well, you were a part of it. Well, of course, I was working there as a whistleblower, and I came forward when I thought it was something that had to be reported, and they were breaking the law. But the problem here is that this was covered up by the Obama administration. Hillary Clinton only got 4,700 names out of 19,000, George. That's a 75% failure rate. Why didn't you get all 19,000 names? So if four people rob a bank, you only get one of them and you let the other three go? So this is very dangerous.
Now, how did you wind up having to serve 30 months in prison? Was this sort of a revenge for what you got into? Is that what happened?
It was clearly revenge. The Department of Justice was so upset because I made them look like the fools that they are.
Right.
Why didn't they uncover it? Why didn't they get all the names? Why didn't they even fine them properly? The fine should have been much more, around $3 billion, but they didn't do it because they didn't want to give the whistleblower the credit. That's the problem with the corrupt Department of Justice. So if you look at it honestly, George, I've destroyed the entire Swiss bank secrecy system, but $15 billion has come back to the U.S. Treasury thanks to me.
My gosh. Now, you were rewarded, right, with a whistleblower award of $104 million, right?
That is correct. Under the law, I get a percentage of what the government collects. But
right.
What people have to realize in your audience, and this is very important.
Okay.
I started whistleblowing long before that law was even passed. So I didn't even know that law existed because it didn't at the time I started whistleblowing.
Give us a timeline, Bradley, on this, that when you went to work for UBS and when this whistleblowing started and so forth. Give us a little bit of a timeline on that, could you?
Yeah, that'll be great. I would be happy to do it. What happened was I started working for UBS 3 weeks after 9/11.
So
that was when I commenced working there as a director of the bank covering North America out of Geneva, Switzerland.
Okay.
Then I started my whistleblowing internally at the bank in April of 2005. And when they didn't respond to my request for information on this, legal and compliance department, they never answered me. I resigned in October 2005. And then I went to the board of directors in 06 of the bank and complained and whistleblew again, and they covered it up. Then I went to the U.S. government in 2007, and the law was passed in December 2006. So you can see I was well ahead of that law by about a year and a half when I started my whistleblowing. So it's important for people to put that in perspective. And really what has happened here is, The government has looked foolish, as they generally do, because they don't do things right. And particularly, we now have, why did we let people go, like the biological brother of Osama bin Laden? I gave him that name. He had a big $14 million account with UBS, and they said, we're not interested in him.
My gosh, I tell you, it's so rigged and crooked, isn't it, huh?
It is. You know, the mafia could learn a lot from the Department of Justice because they're so crooked.
My God. Yeah, they ought to write a manual, right?
Exactly.
And they could make the manual crooked, you know, wavy. You know what I mean? My gosh. I mean,
gentlemen.
There's so much. Yeah, Charlotte, yeah, what do you got? Got a question?
Yeah, I got two questions. Yeah, sure do. I got a couple of questions.
Okay.
I guess I'll have to read the book to know for sure, but the 4,700 names, count holders or whatever, who's the keeper of that list today?
Well, Charlotte, that's another great question. Again, how do we know it was 4,700? We're just going to believe the government? Now, that's the first question, and it's a great one. And the other thing is, how did you pick 4,700 names? Out of, like, a barrel at a bingo parlor? How did you pick 4,700 names? I mean, oh, was it, oh, Judge so-and-so? Oh, we don't want that one. Senator so-and-so? No, throw that away. Oh, here's a dentist. Oh, here's a doctor. Oh, here's a, you know, a carpenter or whatever. I mean, number one, we don't know if they got 4,700 names. Number two, we don't know how they selected the names. And number three, who's holding those names now? Exactly correct. And that's why this is so frustrating. And the American people, once again, have been cheated by the Department of Justice. That's not only Eric Holder at the time, but Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton. These three stooges have absolutely taken control of this because they were all a part of it.
Right. Eric they were all hiding money or for clients or something. They were involved, you're saying.
Well, Barack Obama was taking millions of dollars from UBS for his campaign while they were under criminal investigation. That's wonderful. That's such a great legacy he's got going. And then you've got Hillary, who doesn't even get all the names and gets involved in a criminal investigation and sends two Guantanamo detainees from Cuba to Switzerland to settle the case.
Oh, my gosh.
Obama wanted to get rid of these people from Cuba, but he does it on a tax fraud case that was lasting decades involving billions of dollars?
Right. Now, you're the only one that served time in federal prison. Is that right?
That is correct. You scapegoat the whistleblower.
So, now, these other people, they suffered, what, fines and things like that? Is that what ended up? They just paid fines, but they could have criminally prosecuted them, but they did not do that. Is that right?
That is correct. They cherry picked a few people, but all the bankers walked away free. Nobody got prosecuted. They acted as though they cooperated. They didn't cooperate. I gave them those names and I was the one who came forward and they turned the tables on me. So the DOJ is a bunch of fraudsters. Every one of them in the tax division.
Right. Charlotte, was that second question you had?
Well, I don't mean to change the subject, but I wanted to get your reaction to Obama's pardoning of Bradley Chelsea Manning or whatever that person is, whoever that person is.
It's Chelsea Manning now. We don't have to get into it.
Yeah. But just your reaction to his doing that. And also Trump, is he entangled in this?
Well, I don't think President-elect Trump is involved in this, but President Obama to commute. I think he commuted the sentence. He didn't pardon.
Right, he commuted. Yeah, that's right. But he has to. I think he's going to be released in May of this year. But that was a 35-year sentence, so he did commute most of it. That's a big portion of it.
Well, it certainly is, and you know, people go back and forth whether he was right or wrong in doing this. And it's very hard to put your finger on it. It's an emotional issue, and it's very hard to understand. But I would take it, I would sort of answer it this way.
Okay.
Because of my own personal experience, I wrote a letter to the president and asked him specifically for a pardon. Unfortunately, nobody in the pardon office or the White House ever responded to our repeated requests. I brought more money back into the United States than any single person in the history, repeat, the history of the United States. So why is it that you wouldn't give me a pardon, but yet you would pardon this guy? So I would say, quite frankly, the president, once again, is delusional in the way in which he looked at the way he pardons people, drug dealers and so forth. I understand some people got prosecuted unfairly, but my case is so blatant and so clear. But the problem is the president was taking millions of dollars from the same bank that I exposed. No, I never expected for him to give me a pardon.
Right. I got you. We have the top 10 UBS fines listed in here also on our talking points on our website. But so UBS was operating on an international basis, so there were problems they had with all other countries. Is that correct?
Well, I've helped foreign governments overseas. I'm over here in Italy now, and I've helped French government, and the French government now has $1.4 billion in escrow. They're probably going to go to a trial or settlement there. The German government, I helped recover hundreds of millions. The British government, the Canadian government, the Norwegian government, the Greek government. It just goes on and on, Georgia Charlotte. And I think your audience should be shaking their head and saying, wait a minute, here's a guy who's not only helped his own country, he's helped other countries. Why are we prosecuting this guy?
Right. Well, you know, right now, there's the World Economic Forum, and Charlotte and I have been following that for years. And they don't even bring up any of these issues, do they, at those conferences? I mean, and it's what they always try to portray themselves as is a great humanitarian economist for the world, and we're going to help people, right? But, I mean, they're, that yeah. UBS is right there. It's one of the sponsors of the World Economic Forum.
You know, George, this is probably the clearest point ever, and every media outlet is guilty here. Reuters, right. Bloomberg, New York Times, Wall Street Journal. Why is it the largest tax fraud in U.S. history exposed by a whistleblower in Switzerland, and the World Economic Forum acts as though they're so above it all and have all these celebrities and politicians fly in spending millions and millions of dollars, and they don't ever address the issue of offshore tax evasion? Why?
Exactly. And, you know, another thing that I personally am peeved about is I did two conferences on Fukushima in 2014. Charlotte and I produced two conferences held in Austin, and they're not even bringing that up at this World Economic Forum as a world problem. And it's a critical problem, Fukushima is.
Well, I can tell you right now, just think of it this way. What we saw was a lot of dictators putting their money in Switzerland.
Yes.
People like Marcos and Bhutto and Arafat and Gaddafi and many, many, many others. And what they're doing is, in effect, they're stealing from their people. The people
yes.
are going hungry. They don't have homes. They don't have proper infrastructure. And these people are going around with these huge multi-million-dollar homes and yachts and jets. And the people are suffering. That's why the U.S. government is wrong. Not just for not going after the Americans who had these accounts, but for going after these banks who are helping aid and abet tax evasion on a global basis. And that's very
gentlemen.
Scary. Yeah,
gentlemen,
yeah, Charlotte. What do you got? What do you got, Charlotte?
May I ask, since the time frame of this transpiring, what about Israel? You know, they're a prominent player on the world stage, it seems to me. And what would you say, were they at all involved with any of this?
Well, let's put it to you this way. Again, coming back to Geneva, where I live. Now, there's three big cities in Switzerland, primarily for the banking. There's Zurich, which is German-speaking, Geneva, French-speaking, and Lugano, Italian-speaking. And the country's about 7.5 million people, to give your audience an idea of the size of the country. And it was founded in 1291. So it just gives you an idea. Now, when a bank opens up operations in Switzerland, whether it's a French bank, a German bank, an Israeli bank, an American bank, it is actually a Swiss bank because it's then incorporated under Swiss law. So, to answer your question, yes, there were Israeli banks that were set up in Geneva and Zurich that handled a lot of money. So, they are a part of this. All of the banking sectors are part of it because they were all setting up operations there. J.P. Morgan, Citibank, Deutsche Bank, HSBC, BNP, Credit Lyonnais, all of these banks from all over the world were set up in Switzerland. So they can't say they didn't know what was going on.
Right, exactly. And that Bank of International Settlements, it helped facilitate, according to some sources, like Adam Labar and then transfers of Martin Bormann's Mozzi money through Switzerland to Argentina and other countries.
Well, see, this is exactly the problem. You don't
so
have
it's big money, billions, you know?
Oh, and back then, George, we're going back 70
yeah,
years.
Yeah, this is not.
You know, and I think what you have here is you have a complicit country. If you indicted UBS, that would be like indicting the Swiss government.
Yes,
and
yes.
They had to
have the power base at the very top to shelter them from federal prosecution from the Swiss authorities at the top, did they not?
Well, this is correct. And
politics, politics.
Politics
huh?
and corruption. Remember
right.
Iran-Contra scandal. You had all these guys washing money through Switzerland, and that was General Secord, and all these, Ollie North and people were doing some nefarious acts. But even more importantly, just recently under the Obama administration, we were sending private jets out of Geneva to Tehran full of cash.
Right, right.
So your audience should be scratching their head and saying, this guy is leaving office, and he's trying to portray himself as a great president with a legacy? I tend to differ with him entirely and say he was a failure. He wasn't a great president.
Well, now what's your take on the Fed on this quantitative easing? Dutch Bank was at the top of the list that they funded to get them through. And right now it looks like that I'm watching some of the World Economic Forum people testify. I don't think they know how to solve this economic world problem. What do you think?
Well, the problem is you get politicians who get involved, and they may come in with the good intentions, but unfortunately, they're out of their league. Most of them don't really understand where to come with the solutions, real solutions, not just sort of rhetoric. And I think there's so much money at stake, and the world is so complex, and if we don't start fixing some of these problems, you're going to have massive problems. The banking sector always seems to have problems because they get away with it. They don't prosecute them. They set a bad precedent. There's no deterrent. So, as I've always said, I call it political prostitution. You write a check and you move on.
Right. You know, Rogoff out of Harvard, Kenneth Rogoff, wrote a book on debt. It looks like to me that the debt that's been created is what's bogging down the world international economics. What would your comments be on something like that?
Well, the problem, again, we have is we don't have accountability or transparency in the United States with respect to the debt. There is
okay.
so much debt and so many receivables. Think about Medicare and Medicaid. Think about the pensions. Think about all these monies that have to be paid down the road, and we're not accounting for it, let alone the infrastructure for the United States, roads and bridges and schools and so forth. So what we have here is we have a ticking time bomb, and a lot of people try to poo-poo it, but the problem is this. When it becomes that big, as the debt is $20 trillion now, how are we ever going to dig ourselves out of this hole?
Exactly, exactly.
But and gentlemen,
yeah,
I have to
yeah.
ask this question. There's
what?
A meme. There's a meme, and this is the year 2016. You know, 2016. There's a meme out there that says, "Well, you know, who is the Earth? Who do we owe this money to? This inflationary money. You know, these derivatives, these things. You know, how is it? How does that affect me, the individual, within the larger framework?"
Well, it'll affect you in many ways because what happens is the U.S. government. It's like a big credit card. They just keep borrowing money and printing money. What that does is it destabilizes the markets in several ways. One, it can devalue your currency and your buying power. So if you buy something from overseas, whether you buy a computer from Japan or you buy furniture in Europe or wherever you're buying outside the United States, because we don't make that much things there, you have to use dollars to convert it to the foreign currency. So that's the first problem. The second problem is that people who don't understand that the government is just printing money willy-nilly, this is not good economic policy. It's just printing money for the sake of printing money, and you owe foreign governments all this money because you're selling your debt, and they're buying your debt. So you've got to pay them interest on that debt. So that's not good for a healthy economy. And I
let me ask you this, gentlemen. If this is truly a war economy and we're leaving out the armaments and the warfare aspect of this, I mean, nuclear submarines. I mean, think of the price tags on these things. These are huge sums of money.
That F-35 is a ridiculously high price, is it not?
Well, I think we can all agree that, you know, if we look in any town, Aaron, I've been to Austin, Texas before, great city, and
right.
when you look at it and you think about maybe a school for children or a hospital for elderly people, you could take one or two of these F-35s and say, we're not going to make those. Oh, that's $50 million. Oh, geez, I think we could make a school for $50 million.
Right, right. This group in the World Economic Forum also, they get into public-private operations. And, boy, they love that, do they not?
Well, again, this is like an elite club where they're acting as though that they know all the answers. But if they knew all the answers, why are we in such a quagmire now?
And that's why
people are upset.
You know, Bradley, you make a good point. I've been watching this World Economic Forum, and Charlotte and I have been watching it for about 10 years, as long as we've been on the air. And this is the first time the last few years they don't have any answers anymore on this world economic slowdown. And they're talking about helicopter money where they're, you know, that gets crazy, does it not?
Well, again, these folks are sitting in there, you know, eating expensive meals, sitting at expensive restaurants. Why don't they just go to like a very basic town rather than have to go to Switzerland to do this? The mother of all tax evasion countries, which they don't even address, as we said before, and say to ourselves, look, we don't need you to be in high-priced places. Yes, you're dignitaries, that's fine, but now we want some real solutions. We want it on paper, like a three-page paper showing us exactly what you're going to do, rather than drinking champagne and eating caviar and talking nonsense to all your colleagues from around the world. This is just absolutely ludicrous, in my opinion.
Now that this Swiss bank secrecy thing has been closed down to a degree, are there other banks in the world, like in Singapore or China, that are opening up bank accounts for people? So they just open up secret bank accounts in other countries now. Is that what's going on? My question to you, Charlotte, are you there too?
Yes, I am, gentlemen.
Okay. Anyway, The question that I put forward was, now that the focus is off of Switzerland and they're, you know, somewhat remediating some of the secrecy problems, how about these other international banks all over the world in Singapore and China and in Indonesia, whatever? Have they picked up the ball in establishing secret bank accounts for people? Is that what's happened?
Well, again, you've got several angles here. You've got foreign governments that are allowing these banks to operate within their jurisdiction. So you have certain jurisdictions that do allow this. You have Macau, Singapore, Dubai, Cyprus, and several others, Luxembourg, Monaco. And that's one thing. The second thing is that people can then hide money now because the government failed to go after them, so they got smarter. So what they did was put monies in other people's names. They hid their assets in other jurisdictions, in other financial institutions. So all of a sudden, the money runs away, and they can't get it. And this is why the government is so incompetent, and they're part of the problem, because they really didn't solve the problem. They only went after a little piece of it.
I see. I got you. So really, these people are just moving their money into another country or something, and, you know, IRS can't get that information, right? So the problem still exists, right?
Well, they couldn't get it without me. I came in as a whistleblower, and then they attacked me, and then all of a sudden they screwed up the case, and now the money has vanished and gone underground even deeper.
So we've got the same problem. The wealthy have the means, they have the insights and the knowledge, and other people are helping them. So are there fees that are charged people that want to put money in secret bank accounts? Is that the way it works?
Well, see, the thing is that people always want to hide their money, as I said before, from either the tax man, a business partner, a spouse, and so on and so forth. So this is really getting squeezed a bit, but they're still finding ways to do it. And until you eradicate the problem, it will still be persisting.
Okay. But what I'm saying is, right now, like if a person can hide money and save 30-40% in taxes, is he willing to pay 10% to help get that account? Is that what are the banks charging fees for on the account holders for secret bank accounts? Does it vary quite a bit?
Well, it could range from, say, 3-5%. But again, if you're saving 50% in tax, you know, who cares about making the investment of 5%? So you're saving 45%.
Right, exactly. So and when you're saying 5% of a million, that's $5,000. That's some money, isn't it?
Well, this is exactly right. And then the money gets invested, and the money generates income. So all of a sudden, you can't even begin to realize the magnitude of this money. And again, the government keeps trying to claim credit for this, when in fact, it was all due to me. I came forward as a courageous whistleblower and exposed it. And look what I did for my country. I mean, billions and billions of dollars came back.
Right. So really, you helped the average citizen, a United States citizen, quite a bit, did you not?
Well, that's it. Every American should say, geez, you know, if we had many more whistleblowers like Birkenfeld, we'd all be better off, because they're eradicating criminal activity. You're bringing money back to the taxpayers who deserve it. And now it's a better society we live in. We should embrace whistleblowers.
Right, right. With the way it exists today, and where they can hide it, their money in other places, then you have repatriated about $15 billion. Your actions have in your whistleblowing, and I thank you for your help on that. So they've repatriated $15 billion back to the U.S. Treasury. Is that right?
That is correct, and counting. They're still collecting money.
Oh, that's right, because you have this in France? There's still litigation there?
There's litigation in France and in Greece and all these other countries, and quite frankly, I'm helping the world become a better place, and it's taking one guy to go out of his way to do it. That's what's incredible.
Right, right. Now...
Well, I'm sure proud of you.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Charlotte.
Hey, Bradley, we have you on here because we believe in what you're doing, okay?
Well, I appreciate that. I really do. And, you know, I spent a lot of time in Texas, a lot of great people down there. I've had a lot of fun. And I think people, if they read my book, Lucifer's Banker, and go check the website, lucifersbanker.com, they'll understand that this is a monumental story.
Yeah, what kind of reception are you getting, and are you traveling speeches and so forth at different bookstores, or what are you doing right now in Europe? Are you helping out some of the bankers and some of the treasury departments of the different countries? Is that what's going on?
Well, I'm doing several things. I'm not only helping foreign governments at this time and giving them advice and documentation and strategy, but I'm also signing book publishing deals in foreign countries in foreign languages so that I can educate the Germans, the French, the Italians,
right,
the Japanese, the Chinese, and all these people. So in Asia and Europe, I'm doing book deals as well as I'm lecturing. And I'm lecturing to lawyers and bankers and compliance people, so they understand why it's important to do what I did, why
right.
it's important for society. And then,
right.
of course, I will sign books for people. I will go to schools and lecture to universities, law schools, business schools for people, and help them understand that this is such a big story and it'll never happen again. This is a one-shot deal.
You know, have you been approached about a movie on this subject?
Well, I've already been approached by several studios in Hollywood, and they're quite excited. So this is going to be something in the next 6 to 12 months. We'll see where this all develops, and I'm looking forward to doing a movie so that the people can
Well, it
really
sounds like I can see you zooming around Switzerland in a Ferrari or something. You know what I mean? You know what happened today, just recently in Austin, Texas? Someone that had a Ferrari ran off the road here in Austin just in the last day. It's been raining a lot here just today and over the last couple of days. But so someone with a Ferrari had an accident, ran off the road. But now you're in doing this and doing this whistleblowing, did your life read like a spy novel, or tell us a little bit of interesting things that might have happened along the way as this thing unfolded in your life?
Well, it unfolded in many ways, because remember, we manage money for the wealthy people around the world, and in our department, we cover the United States. And I think what happens is that we went to some of the greatest events around the world to cater and entertain them. I used to go to Super Bowls, I used to go to the Wimbledon tennis matches, I used to go to the beer festival at Oktoberfest in Munich.
Oh, the Oktoberfest, yeah, I've been there, man, that's great.
It's such a great time, and I think people really enjoy themselves. And we were fortunate, because I was able to travel around the world and
see people, and actually I made them money. I made them a lot of money. I worked very hard for my clients and made sure that they were treated fairly. But when the bank was really pushing this business, they were breaking the law, and that's when I said enough's enough, and I had to report it. Not only did I report it internally and then resign when they didn't answer me, but then I went to my own government, and that's what happened.
Did the banks at one point try to go after you in a legal way or try to harm you in any way?
No, they didn't. I actually had to sue them for my bonus, and I won that. But they had no case because the U.S. government came after them with a vengeance. And if you look on my website, you'll see the UBS scandal. It is so extensive. There were Senate reports and government accountability reports and hearings and fines. Oh, this is very, very serious. But the U.S. government failed to do their job properly, I can tell you that.
Now, one point in here, it says Russia to get access to citizens' financial information in 80 countries. So the Russians, some of those oligarchs over there that have accumulated billions, I guess they were putting money in Switzerland and all over the world during that period in Russia when it was on a decline or when the oligarchs were strong there. Is that right?
Well, that's exactly right. What's happened here is I think the problem is that money goes to try and hide, and they get it out of their own country so that it can't be touched. And a lot of that money made its way to Switzerland. We had a huge Russian desk, and it really made a lot of sense for people to say, hey, what's going on here? This is really serious. So it was quite bad, really, really bad.
You know, also, you say the AEOI system, it's a global standard introduced by the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, is to fight tax evasion. Is that going to have... I guess just in certain countries, will that have an effect?
Well, I think it's an organization without teeth, and the problem is these people don't really understand that you have to do more than just have policies and procedures. You've got to really have something that makes sense. And I just haven't seen it. I just haven't seen people do it. They should be calling me to testify and give them advice on how to go about it because we really need some solutions here, not a lot of rhetoric and politicians speaking.
You know, it occurs to me that at the source of payment is where you should collect taxes, you know. Now there have been some proposals out of our U.S. Congress to put a tax on all transactions in stock markets and bond markets and things like that. What do you think about that?
Well, I think the problem is the tax code is too complicated to begin with. The first and foremost, people should be able to do their own taxes without hiring a lawyer and an accountant. I think that's the most important thing. If you can't do that, then there's something seriously wrong with the tax code. And the problem is the lawyers and lobbyists and accountants all push for complicated systems, so Americans have to pay these outrageous fees to file their own taxes. Put a flat tax in place. A flat tax that is two- or three-tiered level tax, 10%, 15%, and a 20%. Let's say $50,000 and below, you pay so much, and then $50,000 up to, say, $200,000 to the ceiling, and that would make sense. People would know exactly how much money they need to pay. They could write the check, send it into the government, no forms, no delays, no deductions. It would make sense. It would be easy. And then people would then start spending their disposable income because they'd have more money.
Right. This SWIFT system of SWIFT transfer, the SWIFT system is a system of setting up electronic transfers of money, right? Between banks is that right?
That is correct. It's an international financial transaction system, and it works very well, actually. But, you know, that's just a way of moving monies around. But what we're talking about really here is a system in which some of these central banks are really guilty of, you know, either hoarding gold or randomly printing money to pay off debt or issuing debt, excessive debt, which is really harmful to an economy. And if you don't understand that, then the problem is that what's happening is people are making decisions on behalf of the American people that are wrong, absolutely wrong.
A year ago, we had the finance minister of Argentina at the World Economic Forum stating that the central banks had been creating too much money. And it seems to that it's a recurring theme, I think, at this particular forum this year. But that the central banks, are they out of control in the money creation area? Is that what's really detrimental to our economic recovery, or what?
Well, they're just out of control. What they're doing now is they don't have any oversight. They don't have people saying, no, you can't do this or you can't do that. What they're doing, and they don't want to tell people the truth because the truth would be very painful for people when they understood exactly the decisions they were making. The very fact that it would be like you, George, taking a credit card, going and spending $10,000, and then take another credit card to pay off that credit card, and then take another credit card to pay that credit card off. And that's exactly what we have here in the United States, over there where you folks are. And I think this is the problem. It's reckless spending by people who are in office for 4 or 8 years, and then they're gone. And we're stuck with the bill.
Well, you know, Ron Paul and then Rand Paul as senator, they want to audit the Fed. We probably need to do that, don't you think?
Well, this is exactly it. And really what should happen is the senators in the United States should be calling a hearing on this matter, and they should be calling me as a witness to testify in public so people can finally hear the truth and understand that the government has covered this up, and people are getting screwed, and this is not right. Offer a Senate hearing, call me to testify. I'll be there at any time, and I would make it happen because it's the right thing to do.
Yes, it is. Boy, I really respect your work in this area. And you've repatriated a lot of money to our treasury, that's for sure.
And you have highlighted an ongoing cultural American myth. You know, I was born on the West Coast in 1968, and I've always heard about the offshore account and tax evasion. It's very much a part of American culture.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, James Bond movies, all of these events. I mean, you can look at a variety of movies and real life circumstances where offshore tax evasion has been a part of our society, and the government's done nothing to curb it. Why? Because they're a part of it.
Right.
And this is the real serious problem, and that's where your audience should be outraged. Your audience, if they hopefully they read my book or pass it on to a friend or a family member, can understand that this is such a devastating problem, which was exposed by one man. One man had the courage to come forward and do it, and his own government attacked him.
You know, there was a. Go ahead, Charlotte.
Oh, I was going to say, Bradley, were you inspired while you were serving that time, or they put you in a cell? Were you writing at that time?
Actually, it wasn't a cell, it was a camp, and it was, once again, a true sign of how the government wastes money. Number one, I never should have been convicted. I never should have been tried in the state of Florida. The government picked these venues with these Mickey Mouse judges, and they just are in bed together to try and send a message, when in fact, they should have been praising me because I did so much for my own country. But when I was in there, it was called a camp, which meant it was just bunk beds and so forth, and a waste of taxpayer money, as I said. I was helping other inmates to file claims and appeals because the system is so crooked. It's a business. It's not a justice system. It's a business.
Right. We've got about 5 minutes left here. Are there some points here that we didn't hit on that you'd like to bring up at this time?
Well, you know, I touched upon it briefly there where the Senate should be calling hearings on this matter, and whistleblowers as a whole should be called in to testify because I think it's important. The second thing is that we need to do a better job of finding out when we find banks in America, we find banks and nobody goes to jail. No bankers go to jail. They just write a check. But you know what happens? The taxpayer has to pay it because they write it off on their taxes, and the shareholders have to pay the legal fees. So the two groups of people, taxpayers and shareholders, who had nothing to do with it, bear the burden. This is an outrage.
Right. You said earlier something about our infrastructure in this country. Had Obama diverted a certain amount of money into rebuilding our infrastructure and highways repair or whatever, I think our economy would have been better off. What do you think?
Well, I mean, he spent $500 million on Solandra, that solar panel company.
Exactly, yeah.
That was a great investment. You know, if it was you or I, George, or Charlotte, we'd be fired from our company and we'd be out of a job. But, you know, he just acts as though that's just part of doing business. Great part of his legacy. $500 million out the window.
Right.
So, you know, these are some of the decisions. The Obamacare website, Michelle Obama's friends got that contract. How coincidence is that? And how many hundreds of millions were spent and it wasn't even operational the first couple of months? I mean, this is outrageous. This is how the government spends our money. They should be criminally prosecuted. Unfortunately, they can't be because he's the president. But it's wrong. And he knows it's wrong. And if he doesn't know it's wrong, he shouldn't be president.
Do you think Hillary will be pardoned by Obama? What do you think?
What, for her stupidity?
Well, I mean, he's been issuing these pardons and commutations here in the last few days. Do you think before the inauguration he'll pardon Hillary?
If he pardons Hillary Clinton, he will forever galvanize his legacy as a total, complete failure.
Okay.
Hillary Clinton does not deserve a pardon, number one. Number two, she has obviously broken the law on multiple occasions, and he knew about it. The emails that she had supposedly deleted, a lot of those had to have gone to the president. That's why this email scandal was buried, because the president was involved, because he was getting emails from Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State. That's the problem.
Right. I just see the whole situation, whatever, you know, issue or topic you're talking about, whether it's banking or pedophilia or whatever, is so corrupt. And from the top level, you know, we got Jim Rothstein saying that the top level of the elites worldwide are into all kinds of criminality. So it looks like the corruption is so deeply entangled in everything that it's hard to reform it, because you're talking to people at the top that are involved. You know, what do you think?
Well, this is it. You know, they're part. You're either part of the problem or part of the solution, and they're certainly not part of the solution, which means they are the problem. And they are ingrained corruption, which has gone on for decades after decades. And the reason why a lot of people are very upset with Donald Trump coming in, whether you like Donald Trump or you hate Donald Trump, is not the point. The point is he's shaking up the establishment, and it's about time that America got a big kick in the ass, because they've been too lazy and too pathetic, and we've lost our ground in the world standing. We need a change, and we need a better change. And I think he really believes that. And I think what we've seen in the last 8 years is just a total farce. All these speeches and so forth, we've got nothing done. The world is a mess, and it's very dangerous now.
Right. He's going after these big interests, though, like pharmaceuticals and things like that, that are going to push back at some point in here. And I'm for what he's doing in many of the cases, because he's a wheeler dealer, but that's good for creation of jobs and so forth, you know?
Well, listen, I mean, people are upset. They have to work two jobs to make a living. You know, kids aren't getting educated properly. The food that we serve them isn't that great. I mean, we really need to change the way in which we look at our country, and we need to make a change.
Right.
The status quo doesn't work. We've gone that route. The last 8 years doesn't work. Obama has divided the country on race relations. He's been a total failure. And I say it consistently, because what I see here is that he doesn't understand the geopolitical issues of the world.
Right.
As well as domestic policy. Those
right.
two things he is just totally immune to. And this has really adversely affected America. And that's why we're in such a problem now. Eight years of what great presidency? What did he do that was so great?
I know. Charlotte, do you have any closing comments here or questions to Bradley?
No, Bradley, I just want to – it's been my pleasure and honor to meet you today. Thank you for coming on our show. I've enjoyed it immensely.
Well, Bradley, we certainly appreciate your time and your dedication to what you're doing, and we certainly believe in what you're doing, and we want to thank you for all your hard work and dedication.
You're honorable for doing that. Thank you.
You're an honorable person, and you're a great guy.
Well, George and Charlotte, thank you for your time, and please tell your audience, read my book, check out my website. I'd love to come down to Austin and St. Louis and lecture to some of the folks there. If you can set something up, I'd be happy to give back, because we need to educate our folks and make sure that America understands what's going on in the world.
Well, Bradley Birkenfield, thank you very much for your time and trouble and your dedication to what doing the right thing. Okay?
Thank you. You have a wonderful day.
Okay. Good night. Good night. Good night, Charlotte.
Good night.
Bye-bye.